Thank you for attending session 326, titled Navigating Through Church Trauma. Please silence your cell phones. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Please consider making a donation to Sunstone and subscribing to one of our amazing Sunstone podcasts. This session is 60 minutes long, and we will ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework so that we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters, our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin in preparation for the next session. A little about this session. The future of the Mormon faith is going to find many people grappling with just that, their faith. As the church continues to increase in its organizational behavior and knuckle down on policies, church trauma is going to see an increase. How does one navigate through that? What even is church trauma? What are the root causes? What are the consequences? Where does one go for help and healing for post-trauma? All of these questions will be explored in this session. Dana Hartline, the founder and creator of the Mormon Trauma Mama, promotes LDS church trauma awareness and healing through her website, When Church Hurts. The Mama Trauma Mama. There we go. Yeah, okay. Through her Facebook support group. She is an organizer of When the Church Hurts initiative that is committed to finding effective methods for religious trauma prevention, recovery, bridge building, and LDS cultural changes. She holds a bachelor's degree in elementary education from the Western Illinois University and a master's degree in pastoral counseling from California Southern University. We'll now turn the time over to our presenter. Let's give her a hand.
Hello, thank you. I'm glad you're here. We're just going to start by building a sundae. I have here a beautiful sundae dish with ice cream already in it. So we're going to add our favorite toppings. Whipping cream, chocolate, caramel, it's going to tip over, and a cherry on top. Doesn't that look delicious? It's something that we all really enjoy. But you know, I'm just going to go ahead and add some lemon juice and vinegar. And you might be saying, what are you doing? You just ruined a perfectly good sundae. And I did. Just like that, I turned something sweet and delicious into something sour and even bitter. Now, instead of being desirable, something that we would all greatly enjoy, it's now something we so want to avoid. And sadly, sometimes this is what can happen to our Sundays. Something can be thrown into our sweet and delicious Sabbath day, and we find ourselves saying, I used to want that, but not anymore. Now, instead of being sweet, it's bitter. And I no longer want anything to do with it. How does that happen? How does something turn from sweet to bitter? To help bring this home, I would like everyone to mentally take themselves to Aurora, Colorado. The date is July 20th, 2012. You are at the midnight showing of the movie Batman. Do you remember this night? This is the night the 24-year-old white man who had colored his hair Kool-Aid orange and red to look like the Joker in the movie Batman opened gunfire, killing 24 and wounding 58. I want you to imagine you were among that number. Imagine after having been shot, you had to go back into that theater every single week, sometimes more than once a week, with the gunman still there. He is there every time you go. Going back into that theater is so not desired, but you know you must go. You have to go for your family. You have to go because, ironically, the living water is said to be found within the theater. Your heart burns for him. And so you go. You feel so ashamed, embarrassed, and confused that you were shot and multiple times, and that you are struggling because of it. You struggle with anger that people, in their ignorance, won't back up, giving you psychological error because they have no understanding of what you have undergone. You struggle with intense anxiety because you fear that you will run into the gunman unexpectedly, although you're on constant outlook so that such will not happen. You struggle with intense self-hatred because you fear and even believe that you deserved to be shot. Such is the road that I walked for several years. And although it was not in an Aurora, Colorado theater that I was shot nonetheless. And perhaps the location was even more painful place to be shot. I was shot in a church building, a place where Jeffrey R. Holland has said is meant to be a hospital where people go to get well. But the church building was anything but a place of healing. It was a place of trauma, a place that caused an emotional uproar just to enter, a place I was required to enter every week for my own salvation. Now, the shootings were not actual gunshots, of course, but were direct shots to my heart and soul all the same. And they all happened at church. Few knew what happened to me. And even if they thought they knew, they didn't. And those who knew pieces most denied that I was undergoing trauma. Everyone did, however, see an abrupt change in me. The happy, friendly, social involved woman was now closed, secretive, anguished, misjudged, and broken. On the night of the first trauma, I went home and I cried and cried some more. My world had crumbled. I did not think that such a thing could happen to someone who was trying so hard to live a godly life. I wanted to die. Now, for over 12 years, I thought I was the only one who had experienced this kind of trauma at church. I couldn't find anyone who could relate to the brokenness that I was experiencing. But since that time, I've become a church trauma expert. This is what my master's degree is in. And I have realized this is really a phenomenal problem that is happening in the church. In fact, I would have kind of guessed that more people in the church have church trauma than do not. And most don't even realize or recognize it for themselves, as I didn't recognize or realize it for myself. And it's often not so obvious to most of us. But what even is church trauma? Before we define church trauma, we need to first and foremost understand that trauma is not the same as offense. We hear much about offense in the Mormon church. We have been taught well that we choose to be offended. But offense is not the only level of hurt. There's also trauma. And people do not choose to be traumatized. One does not choose to be robbed or assaulted or shot. And trauma must be treated differently than offense. Just like a slap must be treated differently than a deep, oozing cut. And if there's any group of people in or out of the Mormon church that need more sensitivity and understanding, it is this trauma group of people. But you see, I'm not just talking about obvious trauma, which can readily be recognized and seen. No, perhaps there isn't even a deadlier type of trauma among us. In addition to obvious trauma, such as a death, there's also invisible, psychological, spiritual trauma. All trauma is very difficult to deal with, to say the least. People are not the same again after such experiences and violations. But equally traumatizing is invisible trauma. And yes, invisible trauma can even show its vicious tentacles at church. We will talk about the specifics first, but let's define church trauma. So church trauma is a condition of serious spiritual injury that occurs as a result of religion or faith. It is the vile, noxious, and icky aftermath of intense spiritual injury. Now, in our culture, it is generally assumed that religion is benign or good for you. But if there are problems that keep coming forth, trauma is the starting place that must be examined and rooted out if we are ever going to have a healthy people and happy congregations. Because trauma is the feeding system, of all social ills. This is vital we understand. Trauma is the feeding system of all social ills in our society. People like to diminish any kind of trauma that isn't combat trauma. But let's be very clear here. With combat trauma, soldiers go in expecting to face an enemy. They go in trained. But with church trauma, one is being violated and betrayed by people that were thought and expected to be safe. A priesthood leader, a family member, a friend, a defender, a helper. A soldier is often flown back home and received with love and care, but with church trauma, no one wants to admit it. Nothing seriously bad can happen at church, right? And the wounds cannot be seen. Those suffering are often just as confused. And because no one gets it, the hurt and the blame are thrown right back onto the traumatized. When trauma comes from the hands of those we thought to be safe and trustworthy, our whole neurological system is thrown into chaos. In fact, research shows that psychological trauma is more detrimental and longer lasting than combat trauma. Further, those who have church trauma line up pretty squarely with the DSM-5 requirements for PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. The symptoms are real and durable, and they include intrusive thoughts and memories, avoidance and numbing, hypervigilance, strong emotions such as anxiety, anger, shame, irritability, and sadness, self-blame, difficulty with sleep, and flashbacks. Church trauma ought to be of great concern to Mormon leaders because of the effects it has on individuals who suffer from church trauma and how it affects activity and worship. It is estimated that within the Mormon church, 2/3 of its members are inactive. Leaders need to be asking why. The pain, struggle, and damage are real, potentially affecting all involved, not just individuals, but marriages, families, and congregations. Further, research shows that church trauma affects individuals psychologically, socially, and physically. This is especially true as one considers the research on religious coping. When one finds that their spiritual support network has been uprooted, there are detrimental and unique psychological consequences. This is important to understand as religious support has been shown to contribute to post-traumatic growth, while religious strain or rejection is positively linked to post-traumatic symptoms. Indeed, religious and spiritual struggles have been linked to greater anxiety, depression, suicidal ideation, poorer physical health, and even higher mortality rates. So I have created this visual that I did for my thesis that shows how church trauma often looks within the Mormon church. It needs to be understood, I'm going to point out right here, that church trauma doesn't have to happen at church. It can happen in the home, for example, based on the teachings and the belief systems in the Mormon church. For example, if a man believes that because he holds the priesthood, he has absolute authority over his wife and his children, there can be much trauma inflicted in the home based on that belief system. But regardless of how church trauma occurs, the problems with the Mormon faith start in the roots. Some of these roots include organizational behavior, patriarchal structure, unrighteous dominion, unsafe policies, cultural behavior, church doctrine, unsustainable history, and discrimination. As hard as it may be for many Mormons to accept and digest, these are real issues that many struggle with within the Mormon church. Further, not everyone who struggles with church trauma in the Mormon church has suffered from all of these traumatic roots. Some have just suffered from one root, some from many or all. But we must not dismiss these factors. They need to be acknowledged to understand what is really going on with those who are hurting as a result of these roots. Now, I'm sorry to disappoint, but at this moment, I'm not going to go into these roots as they deserve because of time. And I have, at the very end, I have my email address. If you are interested, I can send you my thesis so you can read it for yourself. It's also it was submitted to an academic journal, so it probably will be published soon. So if you would like to delve into these on your own, you can email me, and I would be happy to give you that information. They are very important, but I also feel that if you are a conscious church member, these roots are somewhat obvious. So the other reason that I'm not is because I feel like so often we get addicted to these roots. If you have church trauma, you just kind of hang out down here, and it's so hard to get out of these problems, and lots of people linger here. And I want to spend a lot of my time with us today on talking about post-traumatic growth, because we really can become greater and stronger because of these traumatic experiences that we've had. And so I would like to spend some time with that. And the last reason is because I am actually allergic to these roots. I have physical reactions to the church. And so I can throw you a life jacket, but I cannot get in and swim because I will drown, I will get drunk, and it's not a healthy place for me to be. So we are going to look at the consequences. So because of what we find in the roots, we're going to have an influx of consequences. And it's important that we look at these. And I would suggest that most of us are going to recognize ourselves in the branches or others that we know. Because as I said earlier, I propose that most of us have some form of church trauma. But we don't get down to the roots and we don't really understand why we have these symptoms and these problems that we have. And until we really delve into the root source, we're just going to be hanging out in the branches and we're never really going to find true health and healing. So the first one that we're going to look at is cognitive dissonance. And this has a lot of variations. My thesis goes into more, but I'm just going to focus on one section of it. So when it comes to church, too often religious organizations and its leaders are deemed incapable of inflicting suffering or engaging in any kind of wrongdoing or abuse. So when abuse does occur, severe cognitive dissonance will often arise within the victims as they struggle between the horrors of the abuse and the perception of the clergy's divine authority. Attempts to resolve this dissonance often involve the victims blaming themselves, which are often reinforced by the perpetrator's affirmative statements. They'll quickly tell you, you are at fault here. Thus, too often, is it in an attempt to meet the needs for community or attachment to God, the victims will internalize the abuse. They will sadly adopt the belief that they are sinful, thus allowing themselves to retain the beliefs that the perpetrators are good. This also helps them from avoiding the shattering of their religious worldview. However, by using this method of resolving cognitive dissonance, the victims pay a large price through the adoption of fear, confusion, self-criticism, self-loathing, for circumstances that are completely beyond their control. So the next we have is church exodus. After experiencing church trauma, many find that they lack safety, feelings of safety at church. Rather than it being a hospital, that place to go to get well, it's a place of trauma, a place that causes an emotional uproar just to enter. And so for the sake of their mental, emotional, and spiritual well-being, people will walk away. The next we have disassociation. Now this may sound the same as church exodus, and it can be. But because of the teachings of the church, there are no viable, legitimate reasons for ever leaving the church. And so, members will stay in their attempts to cope. But in doing so, they will disassociate, not just with others, but with themselves even. They will tell themselves, this isn't real, I'm not really here, this isn't really happening. Now think about it, we see this all the time. We see people at church who are not fully functioning. And we need to be curious about what is really going on and get down to those roots. With disassociation, sufferers want to stay as far away as they can from their abusers and all of their associates as possible, and anything else that triggers trauma, which is often anything church-related, particularly the church building. They want to utterly close off from everyone and everything that triggers trauma, and yet in so many instances, they feel they must stay, which only deepens the effects of church trauma within the victims week after week. So the next we have abuser loyalty. Now, I want to point out at this moment that everyone's trauma tree is going to look different because everyone responds to trauma differently. But with this one is the stark opposite of disassociation. This one says to just do better, to be better. It's the I'm not good enough, so I'll just fake it until I make it, or it's all my fault voice. And so the traumatized, they sidle up with their abusers. They just want to fit in, to look like, act like, serve like, be like their abusers, to pretend that all is well in Zion. And so they serve a little harder, smile a little bigger, and butter up just a little bit more. This has also been called fawning. If you've heard of fawning, it's the same as abuser loyalty. So the next is loss of identity. I'm going to spend a little more time on this because I think this is a very important concept. And again, these are all explored in more detail in the thesis. So trauma messes with concept of self. After one is traumatized by church, victims often have no idea who they are anymore. The Mormon church is not just a religion, it's a lifestyle. Hence, traumatization can cause a complete upheaval of one's construction of reality, including beliefs about themselves, other people, life, and the future. Few can appreciate the sheer terror that church trauma can create. Many considerations must be examined. Should I stay? Can I stay? What are going to be the consequences of either one? The intensity of identity loss terror promotes anger, devastating sadness, relief, and frustration. People who leave realize that they lose more than just a place to go on Sundays. They lose relationship with family and friends, social status, tribal approval, self-esteem. They lose their God, their certainty, their gravity. When the church has been one's whole identity, facing trauma within it is like swan diving into a knell of beds. It's like spiritual suicide, being forced to attend 1,000 little funerals for the shattered former self, each one worse than the last. But there's a phenomenon going on here that needs deeper examination. There's a perpetual law happening with trauma that actually applies to all aspects of life. Let's consider this closely. If you pull a pendulum 30 degrees to the right, it's going to swing until it's 30 degrees to the left. Isaac Newton taught this law, but it's not just a physical principle. What goes up must come down. There are consequences to one's behavior. And let me say, there are consequences to one's belief system. For example, let's say that one is born into a very cradled belief system on the far right side of life, into a very conservative Mormon home that taught you to stay in the boat at all costs. It was instilled that one's very salvation depended on not leaving the church. As you know, right, members have been trained to believe that life outside the boat is scary, bad, and hard. Because of the extremity of this ingrained belief system, if that cradle breaks, down will come baby, cradle and all, meaning that swing to the left is going to be very hard, confusing, and hurtful. Further, the extremities are going to be obvious. The swing to the left is going to be manifested with intense anger and resentment, and often actions of fierce rebellion as well. Consequently, when the cradle starts to crack, the response is going to be feelings of betrayal, depression, deception, and complete loss of identity. In fact, the pain is described as so brutal, so intense, that it is easier to lie to oneself. Faith isn't important. I don't need God. I can just partition off my soul with demolition tape and tiptoe around the condemned site forever. In this spirit, some give up on Mormonism entirely. In an attempt to find some sense of normalcy, many find another religion, or, more likely these days, they abandon religion altogether. It can be very difficult to leave the restored gospel for another version of Christianity without realizing there's a whole much more at loss. Prophets, revelation, priesthood authority, the plan of salvation, temples, etc. Without the familiar Mormon God, they often are not sure there's any God at all. Some feel the restrictions no longer are pertinent. Tithing, word of wisdom, chastity. Finding meaning and a sense of anchorage post-trauma can be the most terrifying and trying of circumstances indeed. So the next we have mental disorders. The truth is that too often when we see mental disorders, we treat the symptoms of trauma. We treat depression, we treat anxiety, we treat OCD. But until we get down to the roots, the causal factors of trauma, we're only applying mere band-aids. Research shows that mental illnesses are misdiagnosed, that what we are truly dealing with when we have mental illnesses is trauma. The church needs to look at the influx of mental illnesses. Utah, which is 70% LDS, is ranked number one in the nation with mental illnesses, and it hits the top specifically with depression. We need to stop hanging out in these branches, and we need to get down to the roots of what is really happening in our church if we want a healthier people. The next we have family dysfunction. Let's be very clear here. When we are talking about trauma, we are talking about families. No man is an island. When you hit a mother, you've just hit a family. And this is often generational. If we are honest and are careful not to canonize our church heritage and the people in it, we have to face the fact that there's a lot of trauma in our church history, nearly right from the onset, particularly with women and minorities. And studies show that children vicariously connect to the pain and suffering of their parents. And perhaps this is more prevalent than we realize. Symptoms of depression, anxiety, grief, for example, they're carried down generationally. And our genographs will show us this. what we will see is that many families have developed STS, which is secondary traumatic stress, due to the pain and suffering of their parents. Further studies show that in environments where a mother is being mistreated, the children are being treated likewise. This should be of great concern to us. So the one that I will address here is shame. We very much live in a shame and tame culture in the LDS Church. And you know what shame is, right? S-H-A-M-E. Should have already mastered everything. We kind of like the shame. We kind of like the guilt and the perfectionism because it keeps us in line. It keeps us down. It keeps us guilty. And we call every wrongdoing offense, thus placing all of the blame back onto the victims. That is spiritually abusive, and it needs to stop. As I said before, people do not choose to be traumatized. Trauma and offense are distinctly different, but we do not give credence or room for psychological trauma in the Mormon Church. So what happens is that too often victims are shamed rather than embraced, heard, and accepted. So then we have suicide. Let's talk about that for a minute. Utah is ranked the second happiest state in the nation currently. There's a lot of happy living in Utah. And whenever you have a lot of happy living, you're going to have a counter response. Utah is also ranked fifth in the nation in suicide. And it's over 60% the national average for youth suicides 10 through 17. This is because research shows that when you don't fit the mold, when you don't fit in, when you are told that that bar is higher than you're able to reach, and you feel like you should have mastered everything already anyway, you're going to have a counter response. Did you know that in a 2005 study, the number one cause of suicide among Mormon boys was masturbation shaming? And for Mormon girls, it was losing their virginity or having a baby out of wedlock. If we want a healthier people, let's get out of these branches and get down to the root of the problem. So we're going to talk about how to promote awareness, healing, and change. Sorry, thank you for telling me. Is that better? Okay. All right, so where can the church begin on this? And I'm just going to do a few bullet points on where the church can start. So the first one is the church can start by recognizing and facing the terrorizing effects of church trauma on its members. It can start by developing empathy and understanding for the traumatized, not patronizing, but real true empathy. It can start by learning the various types of church trauma and what's causing so many to leave. It can start by not blaming the traumatized and calling it offense. The church can start by hearing their voices. This is key. Let them speak. Let them tell their stories without pre-drawn conclusions and judgments. It can start by openly talking about and accepting the reality of church trauma. It can start by being aware and sensitive to family members of the traumatized, because believe me, they are walking away too because of what is happening to their parents and the people around them. It is hurting so many people. It can start by not ostracizing, discarding, and labeling those who are different. There are consequences when we just excommunicate those voices that we don't like to hear. It can start by providing members with direct access to the trauma hotline. When we say that we have a trauma hotline and it's just for the leaders, we are disempowering the members because it's often those leaders who are doing the traumatizing. So we need to put that in the hands of our members if we truly do care about their well-being. We can start by allowing members to attend any ward they wish. By demanding that they remain in a location of trauma, we are actually encouraging them, handing them a prescription for PTSD. It's like asking a war veteran to go to their terrorizing foxhole every single week and say, there, go ahead and get better. Let them worship how, where, and what they may. We can start by providing each ward and stake with an ombudsman. An ombudsman is a person who investigates or attempts to resolve conflicts and problems between leaders and rank and file members. They need to be completely independent of the priesthood line of authority. I also would propose that there should be a church-wide panel of ombudsmen for more difficult cases. The next is that we need to provide education and training of our leaders. This one needs to be exclamated several times over. The training needs to include how to recognize and appropriately deal with psychological trauma. As I said earlier, too often the traumatized do not recognize it for themselves. They are not combat soldiers. And the last one that I'm going to mention here is that they need to support researchers in their efforts to bring awareness and understanding of this very real and challenging issue of church trauma in the Mormon Church. We are trying to help. Please embrace us and do not discard us. So now we'll talk about what can the traumatized do to promote healing. It is first important to realize that in order to heal, one must feel. That means there is going to be a lot of pain. We have to accept that this means there's going to be an actual death, a death of who you once were. That person is gone. And accepting that normal as you once knew it is out the door. But before we can really begin to experience post-traumatic growth, we have to go through the dying process. And there are five stages that I will address very briefly. The first one is denial. So when something goes amiss in our lives, we often do not want to look at it and face it. We just want to hold on to the old, what once was. And denial can have a healthy place in life, but it becomes inhibiting if it is more than a mere means of temporarily escaping. When we are unwilling to look at the facts and we hold to the beliefs and practices that no longer serve us, we deny ourselves growth. Abuser loyalty and disassociation can soon become inhibiting and hurtful to our mental well-being. The next is anger. When trauma victims begin to realize they can no longer do the mental gymnastics of denial, the response is anger. Victims become angry that they have been robbed of their former life, and in this case, their religion. They are upset that they were not protected and that their reality was so unfair and damaging to their psyche. They're often angry at the intensity, frequency, and severity of their trauma. Similarly, exposure to additional types of trauma or other situations, other roots in that trauma tree that were previously neutral, now trigger reminders of their trauma. These roots are also more likely to deepen trauma or cause hyperarousal, so trauma commonly then spreads from one root to more. Trauma victims are particularly susceptible to anger as they try to come to terms with the injustices and wrongs they have undergone or are still undergoing. Consequently, rather than turning off thoughts, as denial does, anger in turn seems to hijack thoughts. Whatever causes anger grabs and holds the attention of trauma victims. Everything wrong seems amplified. The goal of anger is to motivate the body to stop further transgressions from occurring. So then we have bargaining. Motivated by self-protection, bargaining begins as an effort to promote settlement. When bargaining occurs, the parties in negotiation rarely have equivalent power. Many will start their bargaining with God. They will say, "I will be better. I'll read my scriptures more fervently. I'll pray with more earnestness. I'll be kinder. I'll be more forgiving. I'll pay my tithing, whatever, if you'll please just remove this cup from me." Sufferers will then often start to bargain with their abusers. They promise to be more obedient if they can just be left alone. They may offer cheap apologies, hoping that this will make the problems go away. Bargaining is a band-aid attempt for trauma victims because they are grabbing at straws, but they know from past experiences that there are slim chances that they might be rewarded for good behavior and be granted a wish for special services. They just want to be rid of pain and discomfort and go to great measure to try all angles in an attempt to alleviate the suffering. Thus, victims attempt to trade off in an effort to resolve strong emotions. So then we have depression. When trauma sufferers see a band-aid will not and cannot contain the wound, they move into what therapists call the hard work of depression or the dark night of the soul. Depression sweeps the amygdala as trauma sufferers see there is no way out. They are so sad, so hopeless, so alone. They see their inevitable need for change, bringing about the onset of depression, because when the problems are understood to be potentially unsolvable, depression is more likely to take hold. The belief that God has allowed one's trauma can be a great cause of depression as well. With depression, rumination usually takes hold, which is one of the key dysfunctions of underlying depression. Rumination does not cause depression in and of itself, but it does heighten vulnerability because it involves increased self-focused problem-solving. Thus, rumination is a problematic cognitive obstacle, making depression a thinking disorder. Because of the intensity and difficulty of depression, many defense mechanisms accompany depression, including regression back to denial, anger, and bargaining. If it appears that overcoming the core problem is not a possibility, it may feel safer to regress back to former emotions that seem to allow for more personal control. And then we have acceptance. If trauma sufferers do not become stagnant or regressive by pushing through the hard work of depression, they will finally break the cycle and acceptance can begin its journey. There are many actions that can help move one toward this journey of acceptance. One is finding an internal space where sufferers can regain some degree of control in their recovery. Becoming open to internal experiences such as thoughts, feelings, and bodily sensations without judgment or self-condemnation is vital toward moving toward acceptance. When trauma victims begin to accept, feel an acceptance and awareness of their body and mind, a partnership with healing can become a promising future. Rather than feeling that they are forever victims of circumstance, sufferers can take a proactive position in which they recognize and accept their need to mentally heal and redefine reality. They begin to assess a means that allows for healing on an emotional level of mindful awareness. So now we're going to talk about research-based treatments for trauma. Because new ways of thinking require skills, the dying process is often best or wisely assisted through other people. It may be wise to seek a professional, as it is particularly easy to become stuck in the first four stages of dying. So although trauma or PTSD is well treatable, it is indicated that many sufferers do not seek medical attention or help due to stigma or a lack of resources. In addition, to these obstacles, trauma must be treated within the context of the culture and the structure in which it occurred. For example, if a war veteran tried to be treated in the context of natural disaster, that would not be serviceable. We must keep in mind the types of trauma we are dealing with in order to heal. Still, there are some treatments that have been found to be helpful regardless of where or how the trauma occurred. All include an establishment of safety, therapeutic relationships, and survivor empowerment. One of the most effective known ways to help patients move effectively through the dying process is to focus on psychological strengths, and this is what we will focus on now. So the first is to increase mindfulness. Working with emotion regulation needs to be a primary focus for church trauma victims because, due to the anguishing effects of trauma, people with PTSD often spend astonishing amounts of time trying to change or avoid their feelings, especially feelings connected to the traumatic events. So mindfulness can be very helpful to trauma survivors. Accepting emotions without reactive attention can reduce the power the emotions have to cause more distress. We can allow the emotions to pass through us. And interesting, it only takes 8 seconds for an emotion to get all the way through your system. Such mindfulness has been proven to be very effective. For example, it has been proven that those who are willing to feel their emotions rather than avoid them are twice as likely to quit addictive behaviors. Mindfulness has been shown to be especially effective with people who have PTSD because its aim is to combat avoidance with real-time consciousness and acceptance of circumstances and events that make them feel uncomfortable. You have to face your discomfort. Mindfulness can be very difficult for trauma victims who have learned that they are not safe or they are not enough. They often try to control their minds from going into danger zones, and the church even teaches us that we should do that. You control your stage, keep those bad thoughts out. But if trauma survivors are ever going to become trauma-free, self-trust and self-acceptance must be learned. One must be comfortable in their own shoes, taking responsibility and representing themselves with respect and dignity. This is best done through compassion and acceptance. According to the cognitive behavioral models, it is about accepting what is and having realistic beliefs about yourself and your life. If we harbor irrational beliefs, we become susceptible to developing distressing emotions and maladaptive behaviors. These irrational beliefs are developed in childhood, and we continue to respond to these inaccurate assumptions. Now, two practices that have been found to be particularly helpful for mindfulness are yoga and meditation. So the next we have is become more psychologically flexible. Psychological flexibility has been defined as contacting the present moment as a conscious human being fully without needing defense, persisting with or changing a behavior in the service of chosen values. Trauma victims often face the shattering of cherished beliefs after trauma. I thought good triumphed over evil. I thought people were inherently good. I thought I was invulnerable to injury because I kept the commandments. Rigid church doctrine, such as the prosperity gospel, makes one particularly susceptible to trauma, as black and white dogma has been deeply embedded in the psyche. Thus, it is important for church trauma victims to realize that religious factors do not fully cushion individuals from experiencing trauma. Such a realization can be principally distressing for victims to grasp on the onset of trauma. Many have held firmly to the belief that if they were intrinsically religious, meaning deeply devoted, faithful, converted, I go to church for God and not for people, then they would be have greater experiences of mental health, spiritual and emotional well-being, and in essence, they would be shielded from negative consequences and situations at church. Intrinsic conversion is strongly encouraged and upheld within most religions, including Mormonism. However, intrinsic teachings can actually promote psychological inflexibility, thus increasing the likelihood of having religious trauma. There is so much more information on this in my thesis that you can again get at the end here. So strengthening resiliency is the next one. Okay, so resiliency generally refers to the ability to recover from stressful or challenging circumstances. And psychological flexibility puts us well on the path for achieving this goal. Resiliency is particularly vital because it enhances and uses our strengths as we rely on positive support within our environment. Doing so decreases our likelihood of developing mental disorders. And if we are already coping with mental disorders, as church trauma victims are, resiliency is a protective factor that can help decrease the duration or severity of the symptoms. Two resiliency factors we have already looked at. Mindfulness, this includes exercise and dietary needs, and psychological flexibility, which includes active optimism and adaptability. And now we're going to talk more about some specific ideas of how we can build this resiliency. So the first one is to find your voice. Often the traumatized feel silenced, shunned, and discarded. They often experience a social suicide of sorts, and so instead of speaking up, they hold back. This can be because they are told to keep quiet, or they've tested the water and have seen that it's not safe. Yet in order to heal, one has to be willing to acknowledge and speak the truth as to what has happened. There are wise ways to do this and ways that can deepen trauma. So it is important to speak up in places that are safe first in order to build resiliency. This often means finding a trauma-informed specialist. Now, all counselors are not created equally. You need to make sure that you're finding somebody who knows specifically about church trauma and is trauma-informed. Investing in good counseling can save years of confusion and hurt. Support groups are also very valuable when trying to find one's voice again. Being with others who also have been hurt by religion can help one understand, define, and label their experiences. It can increase their ability to speak with clarity and confidence as they see that they are not alone. The traumatized find that they can develop appropriate boundaries to decrease their chances of being further traumatized. Finding and using one's voice can help rewire the old tapes concerning worth and identity, while also developing new friendships. So the next one is accept that life is messy. Now this is for the traumatized as well as those who are still active, believing, good-to-go members. The truth is life is messy. This is true now, and it is true historically. Because of the Mormon doctrine, Mormons particularly need to be careful of the messages they receive and send concerning conformity and perfection. In regards to this concept of fallen humanity, Mormons need to be better at teaching and accepting that men in positions are not God. When members mess up, the traumatized and the leaders need to understand the necessity of confession. No one should be expected to get it right every time. Messing up does not make someone evil, and members need to simply own up to their own imperfections. This goes for the mistakes the church has made and the humans in it. The church needs to own up to their problems in its history and past and current policies, as well as openly teaching the truth about the past. No one needs to pretend to be more or less than who they truly are. Men are not God. Men are just men. Understanding this simple principle can go a long way in helping increase psychological flexibility within victims. Victims particularly need to know that it's okay to not be perfect. We can acknowledge errors without shame. And leaders need to be at the forefront in modeling this. The next one is leave if Mormonism is hurting you. Religion can be a great means of warding off mental illness, including one's hope and optimism. But if religion is not applied, taught, and internalized correctly, it can have the opposite effect. Thus, if a religion is harmful, it might be best to leave. This needs to be explicitly stated because the Mormon Church offers no viable reason for exodus ever. Members need to know they have options and they will not go to hell for taking them. Realize that it does not have to be either or. This is important because after stating that it might be best to leave a religion if it is harmful, there now needs to be a discussion on flexibly considering if it might be best to make the religion work for you. Those strongly opposed to Mormonism might struggle with this assertion, but it is important to be aware of the false dichotomies that we often are faced with. It is often proliferated, that if you are against the church or you are with the church. But this kind of us versus them mentality is very harmful. Even the church teaches that there should be no ites among us. Remember the pendulum swing. We're just on opposite extremes and both sides are just throwing stones. We need to come down to center here. Answers that have the force of emotion behind them rarely provide strategic and effective solutions for nuanced problems. Thus, it needs to be noted that many people find a way to stay in Mormonism as secular participants even after they have been traumatized. It is very hard to leave a lifestyle, and that is precisely what Mormonism is. Still, the ability to think past either-or situations requires courage. It feels easier to pick a side, in or out, draw a line in the sand. However, such choices often come at a very high individual and collective cost. Thus, it is important to realize that there are always three options after church trauma. Stay, keep your paradigm, your belief system about the church being the one and only. Leave, option two, or adapt. Change your belief system a little bit. Many people struggle with adapting because it feels inauthentic and lonely, but it can be done. To do so, master stories, the stories that answer our basic human questions, must be adjusted and woven into a new story that begins to breathe meaning back into life. As one does so, resiliency will strengthen and increase. It can take years, and it can require going option two, leaving, for a time, until greater vision, opportunities, and skills are discovered. The next is, realize that God is not Mormon. In order to meaningfully repurpose one's life, it is important to clearly know that God will not punish you for doing so. Many Mormons are very afraid to navigate outside of their domain. They are often fearful of Satan's power and being abandoned by God if they even think about going option two or three. Because many grew up believing that Mormonism has a corner on deity, they believe that God does not want members to leave or redefine religion because it is the one and only true church, the one and only way. Members are taught to follow the prophet. He knows the way and that he can never lead them astray. Members need to understand that these teachings are simply inaccurate. Traumatized church members need to be wise and look around and realize that God's love is in all walks. Because God is not partial to Mormonism, it needs to be realized and accepted that if someone has to choose between their soul and their religion, they should always choose their soul, and God will go with them. God is not a respecter of persons. The divine loves all walks, all people. He will not abandon people if they leave the Mormon church. He will not punish them if they stay. God is found on all sides. In short, the traumatized need to find the courage to do what is best for them. This means to practice self-care. Walk away if the church is hurting you, please. Stay if it is helping. Adapt if that is the best personal option. God honors all calls, so it would be wise for Mormons to learn to do the same. And the last one here is understand that what we believe is often what we get. To become healthy again, the placebo effect, our beliefs about treatment and circumstances, needs to be examined. What is believed about the religion, and what is happening as the results of those beliefs? As hard as it may be to grasp and accept, especially for those just coming out of religious thinking, the truth is that circumstances, which are completely out of our control, is not what causes us pain. Sometimes we like to think circumstances are what cause us pain, but what causes us pain is our rigid, negative thoughts about circumstances. In other words, we do not feel any pain until we think something about a circumstance. It is how we interpret an event that causes us pain. Now, we need to understand we are not robots. We will think, we will feel, we are affected by others and their choices. But it is always our choice on how we will respond. And how we respond is determined by our thoughts and feelings about the events. When we think circumstances must change in order for us to be happy or peaceful, we are forfeiting our emotional power to things outside of our control. We are surrendering our power. We tell ourselves, I'll be happy when... fill in the blank. But when never comes, or it doesn't come the way that we think it should or how we desired for it to come. The truth is, the Mormon church will always have problems, probably major problems. For true believers, this is a hurtful thought. But if we allow anything outside of us to control us, like the church, we will always roller coaster according to the circumstances around us. We become puppets to outside institutions or events, which is not adult or mature behavior. Yet with the help of post-traumatic growth strategies, we can determine to live and not be mere puppets to events. By doing so, we see that our lives do not have to be reactive. We do not have to keep giving our emotional power away. We can learn to take responsibility for our emotions. We can learn to feel our emotions rather than resist them. This is the hard part because we have been taught to not feel them. But we do not shove our emotions and our thoughts off. We acknowledge and we feel them. 8 seconds and it goes all the way through you. But what we do with those emotions and our thoughts is what matters. We can learn how to manage our thoughts as we study post-traumatic growth patterns. So in closing, my hypothesis on this is that if members of the Mormon Church can learn to accept these ideas and begin to understand the reality of church trauma in the Mormon Church, rather than to resist the reality that church trauma is in the Mormon Church, all who are affected by it, individuals, couples, families, and congregations, will be positively impacted, and healing as a whole will begin. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
Would you talk about what the program labels your When Church Hurts initiative?
Oh, yes. That was last year where we brought together some of the top minds in the movement that were really working. We were trying to find solutions for how to promote healing so that it would increase the availability of help among its members. We did one, and And I have to be honest, I'm moving out of the church trauma work. I've healed, and now it's time for me to get out fully of this boat and repurpose my life. So I am no longer doing that initiative. So it was a great conference, and we really worked a lot on those roots and how to promote healing. There is a lot of support groups. I have it's called LDS Church Trauma and Healing. It's a Facebook group. If you want to go there, there's a lot of help available. And also on my thesis, you will find a lot of ways to promote healing if you have church trauma. Does that answer your question? Okay.
Thank you. This was a great presentation.
Thank you.
Really great. I'm a victim of church trauma. I've realized just in the last few months as I've read The Body Keeps the Score that I do have PTSD. I also wanted to say how ingrained we are. Thank you very much for saying if you have to choose between your soul and your religion, go with your soul. I was just thinking about the song that we sing, True to the Faith, instead of True to Our Souls. And then there's trauma on top of trauma when you start to voice it and speak your truth out after 40 years of silence. Nobody wants to hear it.
That's so true.
They would just rather you stay silent so that they can stay comfortable. And that's hard.
It is very hard.
I've been reading this book, The Body Keeps the Score, in realizing how much trauma I have stored up in my body. And I had just all kinds of health issues just arise, like just in the month of February, to the point that I'm going, like, is this for real? Like, can this really be happening? And now I've realized that absolutely everything that's going on in my body is trauma related. Mm-hmm. And so I have found a counselor that is trying to take me through healing in a soul way to heal my body rather than having various surgeries and cuts and stuff. Anyway, to TMI. People have mentioned, I'm looking into acupuncture and massage. I appreciated what you said about meditation and yoga. I'm doing that as well. Because the guy who wrote the book said that sometimes cognitive healing from up down isn't enough. And, you know, heavens knows I've been through 30 years of counseling and, you know, cognitive work, journaling, if you can name it, I've done it. And so now I'm trying to heal from the bottom up in working the trauma through my body. And so I've also heard about something called EMDR, which I also have not done. So I'm just wondering if you could literally speak to some of those actual modalities and how they work for people like me.
So I would also, have you tried hypnotherapy? You've done that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I think it's, everyone heals from trauma differently. And I think that's the trick of it, is what works for one may not be serviceable to another. EMDR has not always been good for some people. And so I think it's just a trial and error. I don't know that I can speak specifically to what is going to work for you. And that's what makes trauma so touchy, is that it's very personalized and it's a painful process. You have to feel it all before you find that trick. I don't know. For me, I have to walk away from it. And I've been healed enough that I can. And I'm going to Africa and I'm teaching college, you know, so things like that where I'm not dealing with the church at all. It holds no value to me anymore. So I can't keep working with it because that hurts my psyche. So I don't know how to tell you specifically what to do. I know the pain and I'm very sorry.
I'm curious as to what recommendations you have for somebody who comes to that choice of their soul or the church, chooses their soul, but then gets a lot of pushback from family and close friends and the people that are their whole support network of, why are you just choosing to be offended? And mm-hmm. like lots of resentment from family members. Kind of the balance in like finding your voice when that voice
isn't wanted.
Alienates you mm-hmm. from family. And like how, what recommendations do you have for building, I guess for helping family members and close friends to be more sympathetic?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think we all struggle with that because if they don't want to hear, they'll only hear what they want to hear. And I think that I know Nate Bagley, if you're familiar with him, he recently did an article that talked about two things to do for those who left. He's the one who wrote Why People Leave the Church and Never Come Back. And he's now back in the church. And he recently did another article. If you email me, I'll find it and I can send that to you. I also know that David Osler has LDS Living. He just did one about four things and how to help family members. There's also books that help members with this. Planted, is that the, I think there's a book called Planted. So I would suggest get books, get literature that is where they're at, that they can receive, and it can help. I've seen it help my parents. They come all the way around to they see church is bad for me, and they don't want me to be a part of it anymore because they know that it harms me. So I would recommend getting things of those natures that would help you. So thank you. Let's give